So, good morning. Can you hear me all right? I'm always seated behind the speakers, so I never know if they're working or not. So, it's good. I have a sweet little intimate group here today. Yesterday was a full house, Zazen Kai, so I think that contributes to it. A lot of people have their feet up and are sleeping in. And also, you know, in the afternoon we have this solitary confinement, learning to write letters to people in solitary confinement, that workshop, and I suspect that some people couldn't devote an entire day, and so they're coming later. That makes us just the right amount for right now. And what a gift it is, this weather that we have. It was so hot yesterday. Some of us were just sweating in our robes. And today it's rather cool. So I want to talk today about something that keeps coming up in our country these days. This increased, or, I mean, is it increased or is it just magnified by all the media that we have, of this kind of demonizing and fear of the other? Whether it's Syrian refugees or Mexican immigrants. And I'm sure all of you heard, I mean, how could you avoid it, heard the story of the panic at the Texas high school when the young Muslim boy, Ahmed Mohammed, brought his homemade clock to school. And therein ensued panic in this town among some of the teachers and the professionals, the police. What I thought immediately was they are so filled with fear of the other that they weren't able to see what was in front of them, right? I mean, there were pictures of it all over the internet. I mean, it was quite obviously what it was. But the picture of that brown-skinned kid, skinny with that NASA t-shirt in handcuffs, is heartbreaking. So many innocents jailed for skin color, religious affiliation, and any of a thousand others, sexuality, gender. And, you know, it was just a week ago that we marked the anniversary of 9/11. Some of you remember we had a Dogen workshop that day. We were on Barrack Street when that happened. There was such panic and hatred of anyone of Muslim faith right after that. It was amazing. They stopped building the temple that was to be built downtown. I mean, politicians, people who are supposed to have some sort of sense of equity and reality, you know, had really went off on that. And I remember the courage of the few people who spoke up for the Muslims in our country. So that made me think of, in the Buddhist canon, you know, we have this treasury of the what we call the Buddha nature, or the quality of the ability to wake up in every single human being. We say that everyone carries, you know, there's that story in the Lotus Sutra about carrying a jewel in your robe. The man that carried a jewel that was sewn into his robe for years and years and never knew he had this precious jewel and became very poor. You see, that's what we, people can not realize, that they have this jewel. And we, who have some intuition about that, some sense of it, have to realize that every single being has that jewel, that possibility of awakening, that aspect of life that we all share. And for that reason, they are to be valued. It makes me want to say, all creatures, all beings are naturally of great value. The jewel can be hidden. Yes, even the jewel can be cracked. And yet at the center, there is a light, a treasure to be revealed. So thinking about that, you know, particularly because we're going to be doing work with people who are imprisoned this afternoon, and next Saturday we're going to do a vigil outside the governor's office, pleading for more pardons and clemency. I remember the person, Mohammed Atta. I don't know if you remember him. He was sort of like the operations manager of the World Trade Center assault. He kind of made it happen, right? And he died, of course, in one of the airplanes. And he reminds me very much his story of the story of Devadatta, the Buddha's cousin. Because, you know, that story of Devadatta and the story of Mohammed Atta both show us this, what can happen if people cannot see their true nature, their true center. If they can't seem to grasp the meaning of their life as a part of all of life, some sense of inadequacy comes, of insufficiency, of hopelessness, and it turns into murderous rage. You know, in a small way, we could say that's true of all of us here in this room. We may feel inadequate in some way. Somehow we're missing something. But if, and what our practice is right here is that those three periods of zazen we have, when we can put aside the talking, the endless talking to ourselves, and the endless stories that we have this little corridor where we become one with our real nature, which is to be interconnected. And how could there be anything insufficient in that? How could there be anything inadequate there when we connect to our true nature? And when we do that, we begin to allow that jewel to guide us in our life, to guide us in how we are. And of course, we've got all the, you know, ways we've been, the conditioning that we've had from our parents and our culture and all of that blah, blah, blah is all around and pushing us this way or that. But if we're able to connect to that true jewel-like center, I am one with all beings, we will be guided away from harmful behavior and harmful conduct. So I've been fascinated by Mohammed Atta. There's a whole archive that you can see online. And if you look at, there's a photograph of him. Towards the end, when one of his visas, where you see this very confused, tortured, sad face. Right. But there's an earlier picture of him when he was a young boy, a young man, about 12 or 13, with his sister at the seashore. It was a few years before he moved to Germany and became involved with a fundamentalist group. So you look at the picture, and what you think immediately is that's two girls hugging one another. Looks like two girls. His body language, expressive of a really strong identification with the female gender. No question about it. His hip, one hip is thrust out, the hand on the hip in the classic girlish fashion. You know, they, you know, people who study body language say men do it this way and girls do it this way. That's what you see when you look at this picture of Muhammad Atta when he was about 13 years old. And if you read the accompanying information, the interview with his father said, oh, he was always so girlish and shy. What happened to this young man? What fear took his heart and mind to an oppressive and angry, moralistic tradition? What if he'd found a home for himself just as he was? What if he recognized in his little girlish way that he was a jewel of great value, just as he was? So, when I think of him, I think of Devadatta. Now, the story of Devadatta is in many of the sutras, particularly the early writings, but also in the Lotus Sutra. And in the Lotus Sutra, it says that he had 30 of the 34 marks of a Buddha. You know, there's supposed to be 34 things that you can see on a person's body that would make you realize that he could be an awakened Buddha. And the name Devadatta means God-given. So everyone in the community assumed that he would be a great leader. And he was the cousin of Shakyamuni. So lived in a family of wealth. And he eventually joined the Shakyamuni Sangha, his group of monks, and was said to be a very committed practitioner. One sutra says, the Nan Namo, he says, once when Devadatta was alone in retreat, this thought arose in his mind. Who is there whose confidence I can win over and thereby acquire gain, honor, and renown? So here he was, this kind of enthusiastic monk in Shakyamuni Sangha, and then one day while he was sitting, you know, a thought arose. How can I get something for myself? As my partner would say, some narcissistic goods. Something that would make me feel good. How can I do that? No, you know, when we sit zazen, all kinds of thoughts come by. You know, we can take a pass on a lot of them. This morning, I was just kept saying to myself, stop talking. Stop talking to yourself. Just settle down. You know, you don't have to believe everything that comes to mind. But Devadatta did. I forgot. I wanted to read this bit that Dogen wrote about this particular quality of mind that we sometimes have in our practice. Following only the deluded path in the six realms, the futile meandering of a mind chasing after its own deceptions. The futile meandering of a mind chasing after its own deceptions. Huh? That's what I meant this morning when I told myself to stop talking, you know. even though the matter that I was having a conversation about was about groceries. I mean, it wasn't about killing the Buddha. But nevertheless, chasing after our own deceptions. Really good to remember that. Think what it would have been like if young Muhammad Atta had been able to turn off the voice inside him that said he was less, that said he was defective, somehow not quite a man, not a true Muslim. What if he'd not followed that deceptive line of thinking? But in the case of the story of Devadatta, he became obsessed with this idea of power. The scripture said, looking at his cousin, that would be Shakyamuni, he saw his greatness and success and was offended in his pride. And his mind whirled around in a kind of delirium. He became quite frenzied and did many despicable things. So maybe we're not quite as dramatic as the story of Muhammad Atta or Devadatta, but within our own world, how often do we follow these weird thoughts that arise? How often? So good to look a little more carefully. You know, I'm on a E-list with a bunch of Buddhist teachers, and I mean, I'm talking about Buddhist teachers, and you should hear some of the things they say to one another, you know, because it's so easy to do that. Something strikes you, you know, in the email, and then you send it back, and snap, 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 snap. These are people all over the country of varying traditions, but it's kind of amusing to see the deluded meandering of thought that goes on. I just saw some this morning. Actually, well, both you saw me looking at my cell phone. Oh, this is really... So, what happened with Devadatta was he began to take on airs and kind of began to try to bring a group of people together to and create a kind of disruption in the Sangha. And he went and confronted the Buddha with his crew that he'd gotten together. And it says in the Vinaya Pitaka, it describes the scene like this. Devadatta got up from his seat and arranging his upper robe on one shoulder, he raised his hands, palms together toward the Blessed One and said, Lord, the Blessed One is now old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, and come to the last stage. Let the Blessed... Isn't that good? Let the Blessed One now rest. Let him dwell in bliss in the present life. Let him hand over the Sangha of Bhikkhunis to me. I will govern the Sangha of Bhikkhunis. Bhikkhus, not Bhikkhunis. Bhikkhus. Bhikkhunis are nuns. Shakyamuni replies, enough, Devadatta. Do not aspire to govern. And a second and a third time, Devadatta writes the request again and again. Turn the bhikkhus over to me. And finally, the Buddha becomes shockingly impatient and says, I would not hand over the Sangha even to Shariputra or Moggallana. How should I do so to such a wastrel, a clot of spittle as you? And this encouraged Devadatta to withdraw in humiliation. And later the Buddha had him denounced around town and said, you know, this is not the true Dharma. This is a violation of the Dharma. And do not follow him. And because of that, Devadatta's rage and resentment grew even greater. And he felt a desire to kill the Buddha, to annihilate the other. What happens to us when we want to hurt the other? You know, even just with our words. When actually what is hurt and what is needy is what is inside me. This is what needs to be taken care of, not hurting what we call the other, which, you know, a good Buddhist will know there is no other. We're all the same. All creatures, all beings are naturally of great value. Truly, the jewel can become hidden, even cracked. At the center still, there is a light, a treasure to be revealed. You know, it requires discipline to study our rage, our suffering, and to experience it as a means to enlightenment. You can never say that to someone else, but you can say it to yourself. This suffering I'm undergoing is a means to my enlightenment. Consider what would have happened if Devadatta had seen that his thirst for power and fame and to be seen, if he'd interpreted that in a way that increased his practice. He truly would have become a great bodhisattva. But he wasn't able to do that. So he did various things. First of all, he tried to hire killers. And so he brought a bunch of people together who were three guys who were going to go and kill the Buddha. But when they saw the Buddha, they couldn't do it because the Buddha just had a face of love and compassion and clarity. And how could they do that? So they didn't. And then the next thing that Devadatta did was took a huge boulder and pushed it down the mountain when Shakyamuni was walking along. The Shakyamuni dodged the big boulder, but a splinter of the rock entered his foot. And so he was injured. The sutra says, he suffered severe bodily feelings that were painful, sharp, racking, harsh, disagreeable, and unpleasant. Mindful and fully aware, he bore them without vexation, and he lay down to sleep. Then Mara's the devil. Mara came and said, "Why are you resting? Don't you have things to do?" That sounds like our Mara, doesn't it? And the Buddha said, "My aim is reached. I sleep out of compassion for all beings." Mara slunk away, saying, "He knows me." So good, so good. So there we kind of see the vulnerability of Shakyamuni Buddha, how he bears pain, how he takes rest when he needs it, and how he heals himself. He doesn't become a martyr or a victim in that case. In that story, he's not a victim. He's actually in control of the situation. He's not dragging his bloody foot around, whining. And he does not listen to Mara. He does not listen to Mara. The futile meandering of a mind chasing after its own deceptions. That's who Mara is, of course. That aspect of our mind that doesn't want us to rest. We've got things to do. But unlike Shakyamuni Buddha, Devadatta is still not able to stop his sickness. And he arranges for a savage elephant named Nalagiri to be fed alcohol and set loose on the path where the Buddha is walking, where Shakyamuni is walking. So this is a famous story. Drunken Nalagiri, the savage elephant, sees Shakyamuni walking down the path, and he raises his trunk in the air and gives out a loud cry, and with his ears swinging and erect, he charges down on Shakyamuni Buddha. Can you imagine this big elephant? And all the monks scatter and run away, except for Ananda. The Buddha looked the elephant in the eye. And it says, and he encompassed the elephant Nalagiri in thoughts of loving kindness. So here's this raging elephant coming towards him, and he does not turn away, but looks directly into the eye of the elephant with loving kindness. He raises his hand in the mudra of no fear. The elephant lowered his trunk and came over and stood next to the Buddha, who stroked his head and told him not to drink anymore. I added that. Told him not to attack and be reckless. And the elephant was quiet. So if you could think of, sometimes we are filled with these angry, violent thoughts. I know I am when I'm kind of, I get very caught up in the political situation, kind of the language of what's going on in our culture. And I can find myself internally becoming like this drunken elephant. Just, get the racist, get that, you know. So how to take that same quality that in this story that Shakyamuni has, you know, and not run away, not hide, but look directly at what is in front of you and encompass that in loving compassion so that that is not another. That is part of this, and I can work with this. I can only punish the other, but I can work with this. Later, after that event, Devadatta asked for forgiveness. And Shakyamuni took him back into the community, offering him just the same position that he had before. Offered him forgiveness. And that's what is so hard for us to do. Somehow we have, maybe, you know, it could have something to do with our Judeo-Christian culture and kind of background. But it seems to be so hard to forgive, to give over for contemporary people. But it requires a certain quality of fearlessness, so we're not afraid. If we can be like, just like that story of the elephant, when the elephant is coming forward, is to stop and look at what we think is the aggressor, or have we've been aggressed upon, and give them, forgive them, give them that compassion. And that's how we fulfill our vows. That those of us who come here all the time are always saying, save all sentient beings. So in the Lotus Sutra, it turns out at the end of this chapter on Devadatta, it turns out that in a previous lifetime, you know, the Lotus Sutra is always full of these previous lifetimes, it was actually Devadatta who led the Buddha to the teachings of the Dharma. Put your head around that and consider your enemy. All creatures, all beings are naturally of great value. That the jewel can become hidden, even cracked. Yet at the center there is a light, a treasure to be revealed. So that's what we're called to do. That even those who have strayed from the path, even those who have created, have acted in violent ways, who go against our idea of ethics and morality, even those people can be forgiven, can be held in our compassion. You know, and that's what we're trying to do in this community these days. We're doing a lot of work in this area. Some kind of finding skillful assistance to people in trouble. In particular, those who've been incarcerated. To recognize the jewel that's in each of them. You probably know that every Sunday, right now, Village Zendo members go to Sing Sing, the maximum security prison, and sit zazen with a small group of prisoners every week. I think in Miyoko's beautiful talk yesterday, she said something like 11 years, is that right? 11 years we've been doing that every Sunday. And so this afternoon, the workshop I mentioned at the beginning, we're going to, Shuka has organized this project. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing we're going to do, which is to bring someone in who is trained in this area of how the appropriate ways to, guidelines to write letters to people in solitary confinement. And there are some people who've been in solitary confinement for years and years. And if we think about how busy we are, as Mara was asking us, you know, do you have time to write one letter a month to someone? Might be the only thing outside of the toilet and the tray of food that's pushed into that room that that person has. Anything new that that person is able to experience? So it's a really beautiful opportunity for service that doesn't, that we can do on our own time, and we can offer this. So please come this afternoon, but if you can't come this afternoon, talk to Shuka and find out a way to get involved in this, because it's really a beautiful thing to do. It won't take a lot of your effort, but it will make a huge difference to those guys and women who are in solitary. And then I can't help but mention the vigil that is taking place next Saturday. You know, Governor Cuomo, you know, he's caught in that net of what's politically correct, for what he can balance all the different powers. And so it turns out I think he's only given 9 pardons, and 4 of those have been to people who were already released and done no clemency. I mean, this is our governor, right? Excuse me, and knowing what we now know about incarceration and who's in jail, it's unconscionable. So there's a large group of people going out to his house. It's being co-sponsored by a variety of different groups, and it's just a candlelight vigil to raise the governor's and the media's attention to this lack of forgiveness, of clemency and pardons. So trying to encourage you to join with us, we have done some things. We have a sit in the afternoon. We have refreshments and sandwiches for you. And Myogetsu and Rinchō have rented a bus. So we don't have to go. All you have to do is come here, sit, hang out, get in the bus, eat the sandwich, go up to the governor's and hold the candles. Please, if you can possibly be free next Saturday, join us with that. It's really important. It's not separate from your Zen practice. Bring your friends. If you were going to do something, bring them. All creatures, all beings are naturally of great value. That the jewel can become hidden and even cracked, yeah. Yet at the center, there is light. There is a treasure to be revealed.